All right, it's time for us to get started tonight. We last class started another section. It's kind of just give you an update on where we are, talking about the Council for Troubled Times. Are there ever times that are not troubled? Just a question, throwing it out there. I don't have an answer necessarily for that. So we talked about mankind's ignorance, which we could talk a lot about that, I'm sure. And then the value of seriousness. And there's a time to be serious, a value of mourning, and not like in the morning, but the value of mourning. And so we'll start continuing with this section this evening, the value of patience. Now, I know that all of you have patience under wraps. This is not something that we really need to study that much on, so we'll go quickly through the idea of patience. Of course, we know that's being facetious. We're always tested in our patience. But looking at the value of patience in verses in chapter 7, verses 8 through 14, he begins to talk about, starts off this section, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of mind. And he kind of continues this idea of it's better. Remember we saw that last class. We continue in this class, it's better, these things that are better. And when the Bible talks about those kind of things, that's something we want to key in on. But when we talk about something that's better, the end of something is better than its beginning. Has there been anything in your life that the end of it was better than the beginning? A root canal maybe or something. Is there anything like, there's maybe several things that it's better once I'm finally done with that. And it's better, or something maybe you've made preparations for. And you finally have those done. It's better at the end than at the beginning of seeing all the things you have to do. And sometimes we start a task that seems insurmountable. And then when we're finally at the end of that task, what are we kind of rest in, like, oh, it's a lot better now that's done, right? And so that's a lifelong thing. But what about patience of spirit is better than haughtiness or arrogance? Could you say that would be true? A statement. I mean, the Bible says it here, obviously, but I mean, could you see how it's true in your life or in lives of others, maybe? What does patience afford us that arrogance or haughtiness does not? What do we get from patience? If we're a patient individual, what are some characteristics of patience?
Calmness.
Calm.
Tolerant,
maybe. Less anxiety. Bigger picture, somebody who sees things more. When I think of patience, I see like taking time to really take in everything that's going on, listening, evaluating, be patient and making a decision. Somebody who's rash or arrogant, and they're just kind of flying off the handle as far as decisions they're making and maybe not considering all things. And so when we look at those two, when we compare those two things, obviously we see that one is much better than the other. But especially when we look at verse 9, do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools, right? Do not be eager in your heart to be angry. There's times when maybe we have been angry. Anger is not the sin, is it? Is anger the sin? No, and of course, we go to that passage talking about, be angry and sin not. Proverbs has a little bit about to say anger. Look about anger. Look over in Proverbs chapter 14. Proverbs chapter 14. I need to put these sub. That was under here. Proverbs 14, verse 17, and then verse 29. Verse 17, a quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. And then verse 29. He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. We can obviously see that the benefit being slow to anger and slow to wrath, right? Having a soft answer and those kind of things. The benefit in those things. And not being eager or quick in your heart to be angry. So looking at these things, we can obviously see as far as being patient. Impatience would lead to anger. And that, of course, has never been the case ever, right? No, never. That our impatience leads to greater impatience, to greater discontent. Okay, we don't need to get into examples, right? verse 10, impatience leads to negativity. Do not say, what is it that the former, why is it that the former days were better than these? Has anybody ever said that? The good old days. I remember back some when I was, okay, so I remember, I cannot count how many times my dad said, when I was a kid, and of course we were living in an area growing up, it was a rural area, and they were developing all the rural area into subdivisions and all that kind of stuff, and he said, when I was a kid, this used to all be pasture, blah, blah, blah. And then whenever I went up there and visited with Josiah and Vivian, it was like the same thing. I was saying the same. I became my dad. Like, saying, it's like, when I was a kid, this all used to be, oh, no. But the good old days, why is that? What does he say about saying, well, the good old days were better? Is that a wise thing to say? Is that a wise thing to say? According to Solomon, for it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Why would we think that the good old days were so much better than today? I mean, think about modern medicine. I would rather live in a time when tapeworms were something we ingested on purpose. The good old days. That was a diet thing back in the day. Eat a little of your kidney, not a big deal, right?
Maybe it's because we have good thoughts.
Yes. Yes. Could it be that maybe we, like you said, wrote good thoughts, rose-tinted glasses about what we used to do? And there are a lot of good things that we were used to do that we can't do anymore, right? But we do sometimes forget some things that we have now that we didn't have back then necessarily, right? And so, wisdom, and of course every age says that their childhood was the best, right? And so, wisdom doesn't necessarily say, we can look back and say there were some great things, but not necessarily it was maybe better in some areas. Yes, sir? Yes, and that's the tendency, right? We forget about all the negative things. How many of you have ever moved back to a place where you lived before and it was different than what you remembered it being? Like, I'm going to go back, it's going to be so awesome, blah, 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 and you get there and it's like, oh, it's not the same as I thought it was going to be. And so that's the same thing, that same kind of concept. I'm going to go back and it's going to be just like them, but time moves on. It's not always the same.
True.
Although they're not giving us lots of good options nowadays, just saying. So, yeah, but we're not going to talk about that. We're moving on. All right. So verse 11, impatience doesn't value wisdom. 11 and 12, for there are many words which increase... Okay, that's the wrong chapter. Wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. You might have a different word there for protection. What other word do you have for protection? What's that? A defense? Shade? Does anybody have the King James? So that's another word that's used there. But it's this idea, Isaiah chapter 32, verse 2. If you want to look at that, they use that concept. Isaiah, literally the word there is shade. Is literally shade. Isaiah chapter 32. Behold, the king will, beginning in verse 1, a king will reign righteously and princes will rule justly. Each will be like a refuge from the wind and a shelter from the storm. Like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land. And so it's that idea of shade or refuge or protection that we're talking about here between wisdom and money. And so when we look at these things, he says, wisdom along with an inheritance is great. That's a good thing. In and of itself, that's best case scenario. If you're wise and have money, that's a good thing. And then he says, an advantage to those, who are the ones that see the sun? That's like fancy talk for the living, right? Because you got to be alive to see the sun. Because if you're dead, you're not really seeing anything. So for those that see the sun, wisdom is protection, just as money is protection. How is money protection? You afford the things you need. I can have a roof over my head. I can buy protection if I need it, right? Food, all kinds of different things as far as, obviously, you can see those things. But what advantage does wisdom have over money?
Use your wisdom in order to earn in different ways.
Yes, yeah, so you can use your wisdom to get more money. It says here that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Is there any reason why money would not preserve the lives of its possessors?
You can be foolish with your money.
Matthew chapter 6, verse 20, what does that say about money and possessions? Matthew 6, 20. What's that? Well, what happens? If I store up a bunch of money and I put it all in one place, and it's there and it's protecting me, I'm using it from time to time, what could happen? It could, rust, moth, some people could break in and steal it, right? Nobody has ever, killed somebody for the money, right? That never happens, okay? So money in of itself, it's good, but its wisdom is better because it preserves the lives of its possessors. Proverbs chapter 8, and verse 35. And this is, who's talking here? Well, yes, beginning of verse 32. Now therefore, O sons, listen to me, for blessed are they who keep my ways. Heed instruction and be wise and do not neglect it. Blessed is a man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorposts. For who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me injures himself. All those who hate me love death. So if wisdom was writing a letter, wisdom says this is what would protect you. But if you hate wisdom, according to this, then you love death. It might be a little bit extreme, but you understand that wisdom, there's a preservation that wisdom gives to us. Wisdom would say, you know what? I'm not going to try and jump my motorcycle over my friend's car, right? Just example. I'm not saying that happens to you on a daily basis, but there's a lot of failed videos that if somebody had said, don't do this, and used wisdom, there'd be a lot less fail videos out there for us to see. Do what?
Except there's hundreds of millions of views.
Yeah, well, that's another reason. Yes, sir. Yep. Yes. Wisdom stays away from some things, right? What is the difference between knowledge and wisdom? Have we talked about that in here? What's the difference between knowledge and wisdom? Yes, wisdom applies knowledge, right? Wisdom's actually, I can know a thing and not really acknowledge it, but wisdom uses that knowledge. And so that's exactly right. So looking at wisdom and protecting us in that way. So as we look at these things, impatience is ultimately ineffective. Verses 13 to 14, consider the work of God. I'm talking about troubled times and being troubled, considering the work of God is always something that is a benefit. For consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? Can we straighten what God's bent? That's a fancy way of something. Can you undo anything God has done? Yeah, right. So isn't that what God kind of asked of Job? Really? I mean, not physically said, can you straighten what I bent? But didn't God, when God had Job stand before him, prepare thyself, Job. And God said, can you do these things? Where were you when I did this? Isn't that what he was essentially saying? Consider what I've done. When you have been holding these things against me, consider who I am. Right? And look at Psalm 19. Psalm 19 is one of those psalms that considers God. Psalm 19. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. In them he has placed a tent for the sun. And he talks about over and over again the handiwork of God. Consider what God has done. And place that next to this next verse. Verse 14. In the day of prosperity of chapter 7, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be happy. Enjoy the prosperity that God's given us. We've already seen over and over again that the good things we get, what he's talking about, those things come from God. But in the day of adversity, what? Consider God. Consider. Think about those things, right? What can be learned? What can be gained from this adversity? God has made the one as well as the other. God is sovereign in both days. In my joy, in the time of happiness, God is sovereign. In the days of adversity that have come to mind, God is still on the throne and is still sovereign. God is still there. Now, there is some, in the time of Solomon, God did do things to cause them adversity, even for his father David. I mean, there was a time when God had it not rain for a drought for 3 years because there were some things that David was leaving undone. I'm not saying God works that way today in doing that in our lives today, but God is still sovereign in our good days and our bad days. Right? On Friday, God is sovereign. On Monday, God is sovereign. Right? So he is always in control. He is Lord of both. And so when we're having good days, be happy in those things. And when we're having bad days, consider God. Go to him. Consider the work that he's given us. And so he says here, so that man will not discover anything that will be after him. Do we know the future? Can we know what's going to happen after us? No. We're not. So what does Christ say when talking about the anxiety of today? What does he say in the Sermon on the Mount about anxieties for things? Why are you worrying about your life? What does he say?
Today has enough troubles.
Yeah. There's enough today to worry about. Don't be worrying about the future. How many of you, the King James says, how many of you because of worry can add a cubit to your stature, right? I mean, can you change anything just because of worry? You might shorten your days because of worry, right? Anxiety and those kind of things. Yes, that's exactly right. If you want to write out here beside here, 1 Peter 5, 7, and talking about going to God, God knows what we need before we even ask. We need to ask. We need to pray to him. We need to have that relationship with him. But he knows our need before we even ask, and he knows what's going on. And so again, relying and trusting in him, consider God and all the promises he's made. Consider God as ruler of our lives. So again, we're looking at another little section here. If you'll, there we go. The value of moderation. The overly wise this is verse 15 and 16. He says in verse 15, I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in the wickedness. Have you seen that? You have people who live righteous lives, and they die young, right? And you see those that live wicked, crazy lives. You're like, how are they still alive? You know, like, why are they still kicking? Why are they blessed this way? And you know, he's saying, in the time that I've lived, these are things that I've seen. I've seen these to be the case. Now, is this always true? That those who are righteous will always die young, and those that are wicked will always live? That is not, yes, sir? Exactly. So there is that. Did you hear that? As far as the perspective on life, that righteous person may die sooner. Like Enoch, right? He didn't die. God's like, Enoch, you're an awesome guy. Let's just come up here and be with me. Just forget the rest of this stuff. Let's just beam you up. Correct, yes. The evil person does. But, you know, and also, could we not see the patience of God in allowing an evil person to live longer? Could we see the patience of God allowing an evil person to have time to make some changes? Yes. God is not slack concerning. He's long-suffering toward usward, as the King James would say. Not willing that any should perish, but that all should come as righteous. Yes, sir.
There's an old saying that
Yes. Sounds almost like we're talking about what Solomon was saying here, but that's a very good comment as far as, but yeah. When we look at these things, Solomon's saying, I've seen this, and based on what he sees in verse 15, he goes over into verse 16. It says, do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? What in the world is he talking about? All things in moderation. Do not be excessively righteous. What does it mean to be excessively righteous? You're going to go there. That's where we're going. So Romans chapter 10. Let's start in Romans first. Romans chapter 10. Excessively righteous. Romans chapter 10, really verses 1 through 3. And Paul obviously talking here. He says, brother, my heart's desire in verse 1, Romans 10, verse 1, my heart's desire, my prayer to God for them, talking about Israel, is for their salvation. For I testify about them that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For not knowing about God's righteousness, they seek to establish their own. They did not subject themselves to the righteousness of God. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes. And so verse 3 is really what I want to focus on. They establish their own righteousness. For not knowing about God's righteousness, they establish their own system of righteousness. So if you have that kind of in our backgrounds, and then we go to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23. Christ addresses these individuals with their own system of righteousness. They had all kinds of laws and things that were written, their interpretation of the law, that they held in higher regard from the actual words of the law. Matthew chapter 23, verses 3 through 5. Let's begin in verse 2. Christ speaking here. The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all they tell you to do, do and observe, but do not according to their deeds, for they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger, so much as a little finger. He's saying that they have the Torah, the writing of the law, and then they have their traditions that is an equally large book, and their discussion on the interpretation of the law. And they hold that as in higher regard. And that's what he's talking about here, taking that book of traditions and putting upon the shoulders of men and saying, they lay this on people, but they're not even willing, they can't even with their own one finger do anything to lift that thing. And so that's what he's kind of alluding to here. He says, but they do all their deeds, verse 5, to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen their tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor. He talks about, and then he talks about their character, and then goes the 8 woes, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, and he talks about them. So we can see that excessive righteousness. If this is good, then I'm going to do it all the time, right? God says, do this thing. Well, if it's good once, I can do it all the time, right? If one pill's great, 5 is better, right? The doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. Yes, sir. And not left. Exactly. Exactly. And they focused on the tithe, mint, deal and coming, and they've forgotten the weightier things, love and I can't quote it all of a sudden. Those, justice, mercy. So these things that they've forgotten, the more weightier things of the law. He said, those you should have done, they were supposed to tithe. They were supposed to tithe, but not forget the other things. And added and focused on just achieving and things you can mark off a list. And we can do that ourselves, right? Do we ever have our own little kind of things that we do? Yes, sir. Yes, and that's true of a lot of groups that, God, I see your laws there, but we'll do this over here. Right? And it's very much creating their own system of righteousness. And we need to be careful with that we're not creating something that's like on top of laying a burden on others, things that aren't really commanded. So don't be excessively righteous. Don't be overly wise. Why would you ruin yourself? Why would you do that? And then another, some other do nots. Verse 17, do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? And so none of these are something that we need to. So we need to be moderately wise and moderately wicked. Yes, sir. That's the idea. But at least that's what Christ is talking about. And here, seemingly the same kind of idea that you don't burden yourself with things, make excessive vows, and things of that nature that you don't need to do. We've already seen earlier that if you make a vow, you better fulfill it, right? We saw that earlier in Ecclesiastes. But if you're doing that all your time, don't burden yourself with things that aren't there. And that's really the kind of the idea. And we need to be careful with ourselves. Sometimes we burn ourselves up on things that aren't really even required. We get to feeling guilty about those things, and we've done it to ourselves. Yeah. Yeah, like Paul said to Timothy, bodily exercise profits little, right? And that's, you know, I don't run. So, but no, that was a joke, obviously. If you chase me, I'll run. So, but if you look at those things, you know, there were times that, and he's really in that context, more talking about the ascetic kind of deprive your body of physical things, and then that way you'll be more righteous. And that's not the case. Paul's saying that's not going to. Just starving your physical body, while you need to make sure you're in control, that is not going to get you a higher plane of consciousness, right? You'll just be cranky all the time. So don't do that. And so again, as we look at these things, he's saying don't do these things. Don't be excessive in any of these things. And it's good, verse 18, he said, it's good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes from both of them. So this escaping from both extremes, right? Getting rid of both extremes, understanding both. 19 through 22, the value of self-restraint. As we talk about wisdom, of course, this is going to come up. And we look at restraint in regard to sin. Verse 19, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers or mighty people who are in a walled city, is the idea. So wisdom is greater strength than 10 mighty people in a city. And so he says, indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Where do we read that in the New Testament? Yeah, exactly, right? Romans 3:10 and verse 23, for all have sinned. And so as we look at those things, in the same idea that none of us are perfect, right? And he's saying that none of us are perfect. But wisdom is going to help us more than physical might. And so we look at these things regarding sin. Restraint regarding criticism. Also, do not take seriously all the words which are spoken so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you have also realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. What in the world is happening here? Who was the critic that everybody loved to hate, like in the early thousands, or early aughts, in the early 2000s? American Idol? Simon, right? He was the one that everybody loved to hate, that critic. Could we be sensitive, overly sensitive to criticism? Well, they didn't say it right. If they had said it differently, I would have accepted it differently, right? We can be highly critical of criticism. But if we keep things in perspective, one, if we're in a healthy place emotionally, I'm probably going to be able to take criticism better than somebody who's not in a healthy place emotionally. And we know what we're talking about, right? There's people who can take criticism and those who can't. But something that keeps things in perspective, have we ever been critical of anybody? Unjustly, maybe? No, even overly critical. So what Solomon is saying says, yeah, people are going to be critical of you, but just remember, you've done it too, right? You've done that too. So what goes around comes around, sort of what's being said here, right? And so we need to be realistic about criticism, you know. And a word about criticism, we need to make sure that criticism is done to help and not to hurt, right? Because what do we do sometimes? We'll say, well, bless their heart, and we'll start talking about them, right, and be overly critical, and then because I said that, it's all right. It's sanctioned by God. I can say whatever I was going to say. But it was more just to talk about that individual than it was to be constructive and help that individual. And so we there's certain lots of lessons out there about what we're trying to do with our with criticism, but also understand that we've been critical of others. So when people are critical of us, it's like, well, it's my turn, right? If I'm emotionally healthy, if I'm in a healthy place, I can take criticism and say, yep, I made a mistake. I messed up. Or they just see it from a different perspective. They don't know all the information, right? Monday morning quarterbacks, are they critical? Yeah. Or what's the day after golf? I don't know. But anyway, after any sporting event, people can be critical of what happened in a matter of seconds, and you had to make a decision. And then after they have time to analyze it, they can say, "Well, you should have done this, right?" And like, so we can operate from a standpoint. Well, I had to make that decision in a blink of an eye. And so you understand what I'm saying? We can be wise in receiving criticism. Maybe talked about that too much. So the value of wisdom. I tested all this with wisdom, talking about what we talked about before. When he's saying all this, verse 23, I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. I didn't quite achieve what I wanted to achieve. Verse 24, what has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. And the actual wording here in verse 24, what word do you guys have for mysterious? Yeah, it's actually deep is the actual translation there, the literal translation. What has been is remote and is deep, deep. Who can discover it? Is how that actually reads. We're not singing that song, okay? So that's what he's getting at. He said, I directed my mind to know and investigate. I'm looking into things. Here's an investigation. To seek wisdom and an explanation. To know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. All right? That's what I sought to see. That's what I wanted to go after. Verses 23 through 25. This is his quest. Right? And so we see those things. And then the result of his search, he says, and I discovered, behold, I discovered, more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Now, this is not a blanket statement about all females. This is there's some debate on whether or not he's even talking about females. He could be talking about the woman of folly. In Proverbs chapter 13 or 9, Proverbs 9:13, he actually uses the embodiment of a woman, like a woman talking about folly, just silliness. And folly is like he talks about her as a woman, but talking about folly. And so, but there is the idea that it could be an adulterous woman. And the Proverbs talks a lot about adulterous women. If you want just expose on adulterous women, go to Proverbs chapter 5 through Proverbs chapter 7, and that's all you need to know about adulterous women. And you will not even look at adulterous women anymore if you were looking, which you shouldn't have been. So, but Proverbs chapter 5 and chapter 7 specifically goes into the pitfalls of that type of individual. And so, anyway, there's some a lot there. But what's interesting, he says, her heart, whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are chains. Don't get close, right? Don't grapple with her. Don't get in close. She'll get you. So, and then the disappointment of his search. He says, behold, I've discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another and to find an explanation, which I am still seeking but have not found. I have found one man among 1,000, but I have not found a woman among all these. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Now, when he talks about, I found one man among 1,000 and none among the women, he's saying maybe that's his commentary on the morality of the day. From reading Proverbs and that kind of stuff, it may not have been a very moral time frame, but that's his perspective. But what I really want to focus on here is, he said, I'm still looking into this, but verse 29, behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Has that ever changed? What's interesting is like when we read the Proverbs, when we read Ecclesiastes, when we read their wisdom literature, these are things that are always true. It's like it doesn't get outdated. Right? We're talking about human nature. These things are not outdated. God has always made us upright. He's always put eternity in our hearts. He's always made us in His image. We are made in that way. But what do? We seek after other devices, things that shine and glimmer, right? And would take us away from God. We seek after those things. And there are people who devise many wicked things. It's like, you know, I'm not getting into examples, but you understand what I'm saying? You hear about things, you're like, wow, I would not even think that that would be something you could do. I'm sure the firemen have seen things that, like, I did not know you could do that, right? They were seeking out wicked devices. So there are things that people do that are seeking after wickedness. But God said, I made you to be good. I made you to be good. But you, where's the responsibility in that? God, it's on ours, right? God made us good. He made everything perfect, and we tend to mess it up. Yes, sir?
I wrote in the word frugal.
Yes. And God, there is an innocence that God sows in us as children, and hopefully, you know, as we raise children, we're cultivating that innocence and helping them grow in that as much as we can, guarding them. But people seek out wicked devices. Any other comments about this before we close chapter 7? All right. Thank you very much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.